My friend recommended the Beckham documentary on Netflix.
Victoria.
Yeah, I think it is Victoria, about her business dude. But I didn't get round to that because I was waylaid watching the Charlie Sheen documentary. It's a long watch. It's two parts, hour and a half each. So it's a 3-hour essay on his problems or his life up to this point. To be very honest, there's nothing revolutionary about it, nothing really new, but it was still shocking. It was still shocking, you know, the excesses of
success.
Yeah. And I don't know what you put it down to, the root cause of all these excesses, behavior, combination of things, you know, money, bit of delusion, self-importance, that kind of thing. But that was quite shocking. And I've just listened to the Lily Allen album a couple of times. Welcome to Riding the Showbiz Wave. This week, my partner in crime, Drew Masters, and myself, John Fowler, will be discussing some more contemporary things like Taylor Swift and Lily Allen and lots of other good stuff. I mean, boy, oh boy, I have to say that, well, hell hath no fury like a brilliant, brilliant songwriter scorned.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're going to scorn someone, it's probably not Lily Allen. She's got a very sharp tongue.
Yeah.
And she's very, very brutally honest. Did you read her book years and years ago? It was a memoir, autobiography. It was really good. It's really sad, actually. It's very easy to dismiss people like her as nepo babies, you know, that sort of had lots of opportunities. It's actually really hard sometimes for people who've got famous parent to get taken seriously for a start. But also, it's almost like an inverse kind of helping hand. You know, people are sort of less...
Moral hindrance.
Yeah.
I completely agree, and some people to this day, and I know from personal experience, people hate to acknowledge the fact that they change their name, don't want the family name, all that kind of stuff. But do we know who produced and co-wrote, or is it all her own work? I mean, all I would say, the detail and listening to it, I'm almost cringing. Like, God, are you okay? You almost feel like putting your arm around her and saying, oh, you poor thing.
I feel like I've always felt like that with her. She wears her heart on her sleeve
so much.
I mean, and that's why I guess people connect with her and like her, because they kind of go, this is authentic. This isn't just someone writing some songs to
have
hits. It's therapy.
If you are going to record your life in any way, shape or form, remember that, you know, there will be children and grandchildren. So, her kids have got to read and see this. I don't know. I will have to know where the kids are.
I think her life is so well documented anyway. Isn't that part of the problem when you're in the public eye, is that, you know, especially someone like her who's been in the public eye most of her life, it's all out there anyway. You might as well at least be telling your version of it.
Yeah. And that
I mean, I say that as having not read the lyrics on the new album.
I'd love to know who produced. I mean, it's really, I think, musically quite clever. And, I would say there were two or three tracks that I will certainly want to hear again and listen to again, but I didn't really know the background, and now, of course, I do.
I'd be really interested to see how it resonates with a younger audience, because I remember coming across London, I think it was in, I'm guessing, early 2000s, on MySpace. It's one of the first things that really hit me on MySpace. It gives you an idea of how old that tune is and how long she's been around as an artist. And because she's, you know, quite a lot younger than me, I sort of think of her as quite a new artist still. But, you know, for the young generation, for my kids' generation, she's
ancient.
Well, she's a middle-aged lady.
And I feel exactly the same. I still think of her as somewhat of a newcomer.
Yeah.
And somewhat young. I don't even know how old she is.
I don't know how old she is.
Bless her cottons. But
she's probably not
middle-aged. I can't imagine many of the lads, the 15, 16-year-old lads who are busy playing, you know, are going to bother with the lyrics of this album, but
yeah, I guess it's not really for them, is it? It's not really, I mean, you know, her breakup is not really something they're probably that interested in.
Hey, listen, it's not the first breakup album. I mean, come on, what the most famous breakup and reconciliation, isn't that the Fleetwood Mac Rumours?
Quite possibly.
I'd
no idea.
I'm pretty sure that was recorded due to or because of the certainly famously Fleetwood Mac's album Rumours is got breakups, reconciliation, and breakups within the band.
I mean, it's a standard theme for writing songs, isn't it? I remember being on a kind of writing camp thing that ASCAP, the American Royalty Society, arranged many, many years ago. It would have been when I was probably either signed to EMI or about to be. And I remember them saying, you know, when you write, you've got to tap into your pain. And being me, I put my hand up and said, what if you aren't going through any pain? And then they said, then tap into someone else's pain, which I loved. I thought it was really, really good advice as well. Great songwriting, great art often comes from...
I think that might make a clip. That's rather lovely, I must admit. As Eric says, very tap into someone else's pain.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, there's loads of albums like that. I mean, the Adele album springs to mind, which was, you know, very much about her breakup. The one with Someone Like You, and again, very painful, very raw.
I have a wonderful memory of Adele, absolutely wonderful, is that I went to see an Adele tribute on a summer holiday with my...
That raises all sorts of questions.
But for me, yes, I agree that might open a huge can of worms, and the listener may well have some issues. But what was interesting, it was on the very day that Tina Turner sadly passed away. And so we ended up getting not only an Adele tribute, but a Tina Turner tribute, because she was able to do both. And I felt very, very smug that I got the price of one with my three daughters who were quaffing overpriced rosé wine.
We should discuss the merits of tribute bands, because it's something I've never really been into. But I'm actually going in a couple of weeks to see a very good friend of mine who is playing keyboards in a Cure tribute band called The Incurables. Very clever. And they are packing out venues. They've only done about 3 gigs. And they are selling out. People love them. They're really good. I kind of don't quite get it. I guess if you love the songs, but you can't get to see The Cure because they're not playing.
I think all of the above. You know, Noasis. Great, great band.
ABBA.
ABBA-esque. I think that there's tribute bands are big business, given that the ticket price of seeing the real thing are so exorbitant.
Yeah.
Long may these tribute acts continue.
Well, I guess they're helping keep these venues going as well, which is also a good thing.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing. Good. Tick. So all over TikTok this week, or last week now, I guess, is the Group 7 trend. And I'm sort of slightly reluctant to add too much more into this because I think it's been discussed so heavily by so many people. We're interested in the fact that really it wasn't about the song and it was more about the campaign. So quick catch up. An artist posted her new song, and what she did is she created 7 posts across in the entire day, posted them in rapid succession, and basically the 7th one said, if you're seeing this, you're in Group 7. And it just became a very instant trend. For some reason, people liked the idea that they were in Group 7, they were in some special group. And it racked up millions and millions of views. I can't remember exactly how many. I think you were...
When I looked, it was 5 million.
Yeah. It's really interesting. It's become a massive trend. People are hashtagging Group 7. I think that, you know, one of my favorite commentators on this stuff is Stevie Red McMinn, who we've talked about before. He's a really interesting guy on TikTok. He runs a record label, used to be in a band. And I think he's done a TikTok on it, which is probably the definitive one for me, which just basically says what we're saying, which is why I don't think we've got a huge amount to add to it. The song itself probably hasn't picked up a load more Spotify streams as a result of being part of this trend. Last time he looked, which was probably about a week ago, it was about 200,000 plays.
That's
2 million,
yeah,
or million views on TikTok, which suggests it's not translating. It's also, I think he's pointed out that it's also laid back quite quietly, the song, so it's quite hard to even hear it. And what he was saying, and you're always talking about what a data-driven business this is that actually, you know, record companies don't look at TikTok numbers particularly. They're not going to look at how many views you've had and go, oh, that's amazing, because they know that it can just be a fluke. What they're going to look at is how it's translated into Spotify streams.
So my take on this was one of sort of abject horror to begin with, insofar as it wasn't about the music. It wasn't about the rap. Perfectly pleasant, perfectly listenable pop song and a lovely presentable artist. And I thought, oh, great, this is very exciting. But actually my time was taken up being part of Group 7, just being part of a trend, you know, and I feel a little annoyed. And look, we're talking about it and it's using up bandwidth. It's using up bandwidth in the true meaning of the word. And my point is that, you know, there are no gatekeepers. You know, where is the quality control? And I think this is a prime example of what, frankly, it's been a complete and utter waste of time, of my time, being a consumer.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, as you say, we're talking about it. It's got a lot of eyes and ears on that song that maybe wouldn't have otherwise. So you could argue that it's picked up far more fans than it would have done if it hadn't gone viral in that way.
So can you tell me the artist's name?
No. I think she's a victim of her own success there. She's set out to go viral. She's gone viral, but for all the wrong reasons. And whilst it may have achieved some of what she wanted to achieve, neither of us can remember her name or the song.
Well, I thought I could, and I think Sarah can't say. Anyway, you're right. Neither of us can remember the bloody name. And the song isn't something I would return to immediately. There is an obsession about trends and data, which are viewed as sort of more important than the actual artistry itself. You know, what's the song like? Do you play it? What's your voice like?
Yeah.
I'm spending more and more time on YouTube, and I say less and less. I was never a huge TikToker. I like to give someone a good look and a good listen. But yes, I was in Group 7.
So I tend to start with TikTok, get a quick hit, something has to grab me, and then I'll probably go to YouTube to seek out a longer version or more, rather than I might flick through their TikToks, but generally it's quite unsatisfying. And a lot of the time it's the same content, especially if they're plugging one particular song, whereas I want to find out more about the artist. But I mean, lots of artists spring to mind that I found on TikTok really early on, like Chapel Roan, Lola Young, Pink Pantheress. There's been a lot of artists that I've definitely found on TikTok way before they moved into the mainstream and before my kids even knew about it, which is always very satisfying.
Very satisfying. I'm someone the other way. I mean, all the bands you mentioned, wonderful. Interesting, a lot of female-fronted.
Project. I think that it really favours female-fronted acts. And we talked about this with bands. I think it goes with male artists as well. I definitely don't get as many in my feed. I don't know if that's because I've seen some female artists like them and then it thinks I only like female singer-songwriters. I have seen some very young men out there. There's someone who's at uni. I think he's at Bristol Uni. And I can't remember his name either. But he has got a lot of talent. And I can see he's going to be someone to watch without question.
We should probably look at that, the gender mix and how that is working on TikTok. Because if you say my top 10 artists of the last year or two, when I think of the Glastos and I think the 7 or 8 are women, are girls. And I'm wondering, is that because of my, the algorithm is treating me to this? I mean, I try and watch
it. It's really interesting. I mean, you know, if I'm liking a Lola Young TikTok and then I'm liking a Ray TikTok, is it going to just send me everything else that's like that? Is it going to go, well, I'm not going to send you any rock music fronted by, you know, hairy men because you clearly like Ray and Lola Young and that's your demographic now?
Which I think the answer to that is yes, because in my understanding of that, we got this algorithm, you're being conditioned. It's the, 10 years ago, we had the recommendations from whatever site we were on. If you like that, you're bound to like this. So that's been a challenge for the industry.
And that's something, actually, it's another conversation, but that's something that I've always thought was woefully lacking. You know, even on Apple Music, which is my kind of go-to and my favorite platform, the recommendations are sometimes so off, or they're just too on the nose. But often they're way off, and you just go, well, why is it so hard? You've got so much music in your catalog. Why is it so hard to not come up with something that's very similar to what I just listened to in terms of style, content? It doesn't seem to understand really what it is about that music that I like.
I wonder if there's a simple way of looking at the technology behind Apple and their music platform and Spotify and the TikTok music, the technology behind it. Is Apple just older than TikToks? Is it different? I wonder if there's a technologist out there.
I mean, my assumption would be that Apple were always upgrading the algorithms they use.
You'd think they would have the latest thing, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
They have the latest.
I can probably find out. I know some people I can ask, so I'll find out and report back. But I think it is interesting. I've always thought that kind of recommendation algorithm was a weak point in a lot of these DSPs, and it was one of the things that I probably value the most. That's what you turn the radio on for, is to get recommendations, stuff you've never heard before. And you pick your station that you listen to based on your feeling that they are going to supply you with the music that you like, but you've never heard.
Just to finish up on the Group 7, I wonder, and in some ways I sort of hope that might be a lesson, that attention in terms of views and the trends and being a success, having a successful TikTok can be misleading.
Time will tell, won't it? We'll have to see whether that suddenly becomes a hit. It's also impossible to know what's behind each artist, because sometimes you get people who are posting, they look like they're indie, they look like they're just doing it from the bedroom, but actually they're already signed and there's a label behind them and marketing department, and there's no way of knowing that stuff. So it'd be interesting to see if she starts to do really well and release stuff on a major label. It'd be interesting to know when she signed that deal, before or after.
And just on that subject of releasing, and I'm pretty sure, goodness me, I know that I will get, if I do get this wrong, someone will tell me, or 73 million people will tell me, the Taylor Swift album. Well, two things. A, I'm loving the fact that she's got an album out. Lily Allen has an album of works out, which I thought we had, you know, we're hearing the death knell of albums, but I'm delighted to say there is an album and there's an album image. But it all came at once. And, you know, there are video after this video, and I saw the most fantastic Taylor Swift video of, I was going to say her second single, but who the hell knows? It's a single, and it's phenomenal. I mean, it's such a work of art.
I was listening to her latest single on, like you, I don't know if it's her latest single, one of her songs from the new album. It came on the radio as I was driving yesterday, and I kind of instantly knew it was, I didn't know it was her, but I sort of pretty much guessed it. It was so classy and expensive sounding. It's quite hard to describe what that means, but it just sounded like quite a simple pop song that was made at the absolute pinnacle of what you can achieve in terms of sound. It sounded so perfect and beautiful and amazing. And I was thinking, you know, when you're at that level, and money's no object and time is no object, you can create these incredible things. And I have to say, I totally salute anyone who's at that level who continues to do it. Because I think my reaction would probably be to take the money and go and sit under a tree in the Caribbean somewhere. But it's really interesting when you see people like Taylor Swift, Hans Zimmer's another one in the film industry, you know, has nothing to prove, has made plenty of money, but still out there making stuff at the highest possible level of excellence. I think it's really, really remarkable, really interesting.
Well, I mean, all I'd say, the Taylor Swift video was phenomenal. And music video is back.
Yeah.
Did it ever go away? Probably not. I mean, there was a period where people just didn't bother, record labels didn't bother.
There was a sort of the rise of the single, which came with, you know, indie artists, people like Drake, obviously just dropping a song every week. It's fine to do that. I mean, there's no rule that says you have to do it a different way, and it worked for him. The point of an album was, it was a bit like a novel. It was a bunch of chapters, a bunch of stories that went together in some way and encapsulated where you were as an artist at that time.
And, of course, the album gave birth to the phrase, that's an album track, therefore not a single. I remember famously, I won't name names, but a CEO and now global leader of a music company played me what was due to be the first single of a very famous band's campaign. And I out loud, and said, yeah, that's a really good album track. I don't think he ever forgave me for that. And I hope he never told the band, but it became one of their biggest singles. In fact, it probably was their biggest single.
Wow.
In terms of management, when you have an artist that has success, has real self-belief, and somewhat stubborn, yeah, that's quite a tough management challenge. You have to say, look, you know, normally the argument would be based around the commerciality of it. Hey, how much money are you going to make? Trust me.
I think, as a fan, as a listener, it just, it's I find it really disappointing when I see people get into that syndrome that you're talking about, where they think they know it all. They lock themselves away in the studio with very sycophantic crew of people who will just basically do whatever it is they're told very well. So there's this sort of veneer of quality, but you're not getting any real input from anyone else. It just becomes like this smaller and smaller sort of ever-decreasing circles of your talent, and without any kind of influence from outside.
And again, we've touched it before. We say that a lot. The A&R exec, you know, who is making records these days? I suspect there are one or two around, but and of course, because the business has flipped into very much do-it-yourself model, there ain't a lot of quality control and advice going on at early stages.
Yeah,
I think that's a shame.
I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because when you first get signed, you are probably your most authentic. You've got signed off the back of presumably a number of songs, hopefully not just one.
But four tracks on a cassette.
Yeah, I mean, I got signed to EMI off the back of five tracks on a cassette.
Wonderful.
I mean, it was...
Do you still have that cassette?
I don't think I do.
Well, that's,
I might do.
That's, well,
I'm going to need to play it on. Anyway, you know, that's when you're presenting who you are, your most authentic self at that point. Then comes all the sort of the gloss and the changes. I mean, back then, you know, mid-90s when I was signed, we were pretty much left to get on with it. You know, I wanted things like media training for radio interviews. And they were like, just go in and talk. And then I wanted, you know, a stylist help me find a nice look. And again, my manager was like,
you're right, mate.
When I managed AHA, they just went to Camden Market, bought some clothes, mate. And, you know, I think a lot of that is true. I mean, I think that is right. I think I was wrong in thinking that that's what a record company should be providing for me or should be helping with. It's what I needed help with, but it doesn't mean that that was their job. But actually, where we never had any real A&R was with the music. The music was always just like, that's the music. But I do think that once you get onto your, you know, once you, if you have a hit, which we didn't, incidentally, in case you hadn't noticed, that's when it all changes, and someone's going to take power, aren't they? It's either going to be the record company or it's going to be you as the artist. It's more likely to be you as the artist because suddenly everyone loves you.
Yes, it's in my experience over the years, I work with very strong A&R men, but also real artists make their own records. And some of the artists that certainly I looked after weren't able to make their own records, and it would have to be done for them.
Yeah.
And I have a respect for that. They were, let's say they were a pop star, but they needed arrangements, they needed backing singers, they needed a record made. And making records, you know, as easy as you think it might be. So there were some really important people doing that. And then, because predominantly my experience with pop stars was all the rest. It was the styling. It was the videos. I mean, I dread to think the cost of some videos that were produced, you know, 90s, noughties, and thereafter. I think the demise of MTV as a music television channel probably had something to do with the fact that we lost a lot of, you know, great pop videos. But yeah, so I'm more interested now in pop videos and spending a lot more time on YouTube to try and enjoy, you know, what Taylor Swift is doing. And I really did enjoy her latest offering.
You've been listening to Riding the Showbiz Wave with me, Drew Masters.
And myself, John Fowler.